added Mrs. Rochester. "I found a letter." Alexander patted his breast pocket, but it wasn't there, nor was Miss Bronte's notebook. He'd stashed both in a secret location outside Westminster. A last-moment impulse. Now he was glad he had, or they'd have been drowned with him. "It seemed to indicate that you were at odds with Wellington." Rochester nodded. "He was betraying everything the society stood for."
"I was the only one of us who could see ghosts," Mrs. Rochester said. "And because I am a beacon, Wellington saw the most value in me. I was the closest to him, the star agent."
Alexander knew that feeling.
"In those days, I could use the Book of the Dead to help ghosts move on to the afterlife. We had the collection room, but it was only used by other agents who needed to drop off their talismans before going on their next assignment. Whenever I returned to London, Wellington and I usually spent a day or two releasing all the ghosts, but after a time I began to notice Wellington kept some of the talismans. I asked about it only once."
"What did he say?" Alexander breathed.
"That he wanted to keep them for emergencies." Mrs. Rochester rubbed her temples as though the memory still gave her a headache. "I never said anything to him again. I let him believe I understood, but I told Mr. Rochester and I told your father."
Mr. Rochester touched his wife's shoulder. "After more investigation, we discovered that some of the ghosts Mrs. Rochester and other agents had captured, they had worked with the society before they died. That was the travesty we wanted to deal with."
A chill ran up Alexander's spine, like someone had just stepped on his grave.
"David Mitten is dead. I captured him for Wellington just earlier this month." "It was soon after we began tracking the deaths in the society that your father died. Then Roland took possession of me, and then locked Mrs. Rochester in the attic, hoping we might be useful again one day."
Rochester's voice shook slightly.
Mrs. Rochester closed her eyes and reached for her husband's hand.
"Mr. Blackwood, do you know what Wellington was doing with the ghost he didn't take to the move-on room?"
Alexander shook his head, but a sense of doom niggled at him. "The Duke is ambitious," said Rochester. "He was always power-hungry."
Alexander's mind still felt full of river water, so the answer didn't come as quickly as it might otherwise. "He had George the Fourth possessed," Mrs. Rochester said. "The king was under Wellington's control, at least until he died, and William ascended the throne."
"Oh," Alexander recalled, the David Mitten job again, the ghost who wanted to be captured, the signet ring, Wellington's urgency.
"Good God," he muttered.
"He's going to have Mr. Mitten possess the King of England."
31. Charlotte. Charlotte stared up at the ceiling, unable to sleep. At Lowood, she'd slept lined up in rows with at least 30 other girls, and she'd fallen asleep each night to a chorus of their fretful sighs and gurgles. At Haworth, she'd had her own more comfortable bed to rest in, a quilt her mother had sewn for her, and her sisters all cozy in the same room. When they couldn't sleep, they'd told one another stories, whispered tales of dragons and the handsome knights who arrived to slay them. And after her sisters had gone back to school, Jane had taken Emily's bed. Jane had snored a little. Don't tell her. It was hardly snoring. It was very delicate. Charlotte had found the sound immensely comforting. But now everyone had gone. Bran to the parsonage, Emily and Anne to Lowood, Jane to London on some vastly important mission for the society. And Charlotte found herself in a squeaky little bed in the teacher's cottage in the village. Alone. No one had ever been so alone, she thought. And Mr. Blackwood was dead. She turned onto her side. A tear rolled across her nose and dropped soundlessly onto the pillow, which was already quite damp. Mr. Blackwood was dead. Part of her would not believe it. How could Mr. Rochester have bested him? How had it happened? How was it possible that she would never see him again? She stifled a sob. She'd never see him walk that way he did when he meant business, his strides long and his shoulders thrown back, his black coat billowing out behind. She'd never see the glitter of determination in his dark eyes. He'd never again offer his hand to help her down from the carriage. He'd never make tea or catch a ghost or play charades or argue with her. He'd never say, "Go home, Miss Bronte." The tears flowed freely now. It was aggravating, the way she could not seem to stop herself crying over Alexander Blackwood. He was just a boy, wasn't he? They'd had no attachment to speak of. What she'd felt for Mr. Blackwood hadn't been romance, as Charlotte had previously defined romance. There had been no stolen glances, not that she would have been able to see them. No flirtations, no tortured yearning of her soul, the way Jane felt for Mr. Rochester. No, between Charlotte and Alexander there had only been the highest level of regard, a camaraderie, a mutual enjoyment of each other's company. But when she'd heard Mr. Wellesley say that Mr. Blackwood had been killed, something had seemed to break inside her, and it remained broken day after day. So she wept, and after the tears came a fierce ache in her chest, even worse than the crying. Our Charlotte was floundering in the true depths of despair, dear reader, although this time she felt no urge to write about it. This time it felt like she could clearly see her entire life stretched before her, and it was a lonely life. A tragic one, where the people she loved all died, first her mother, her two older sisters, then her father. Now Mr. Blackwood. And soon perhaps her sisters would succumb to the graveyard disease at school. Anne was always coughing these days, Emily looked pale, and Bran was so accident-prone something could happen, and then she'd be alone forever. Or maybe she'd die young, too. She wiped her eyes. It was absurd, but what she wished for most right now was the ability to simply speak to Mr. Blackwood again. You should tell Mr. Blackwood all that's happened. Some wayward part of her brain kept insisting. She had numerous questions she'd like to ask him. What was his opinion, for instance, on the silly way that she kept crying over him? She took a shuddering breath. Crying, she told herself sternly, does not indicate that you are weak. Since birth, it has always been a sign that you are alive. The shutters rattled. Outside, an October storm was blowing in. The wind was escalating into a howl, an eerie, loathsome sound. When she was a little girl, that Yorkshire wind had frightened her. She'd known it was only the wind, but her overactive imagination had produced a theory that the sound was the ghosts of England's past. A menagerie of the dead stretching back through history, all of them come to bang at her window. But she hadn't known about ghosts then. She'd never seen a ghost. But what Charlotte had gleaned from this whole society experience was that ghosts were just like regular people, with typical thoughts and feelings. They were dead, was all. It was almost like nothing else had changed, if you could see them, that is. Wait, hold on. Charlotte sat up. She thought she might cry again, but what came out was a hoarse laugh. Then she scrambled out of bed and hurriedly began to dress. She'd had an idea, and this was the kind of idea that really couldn't wait until morning. Bran! Charlotte banged on the door of the parsonage again. The wind whipped her loose hair into her face. Wake up, Bran! She heard footsteps on the stairs. Then the door opened a crack and a face appeared. Her brothers, she assumed, although she couldn't see, her glasses were streaked with rain. "Charlie!" he exclaimed. "I've asked you repeatedly not to call me Charlie," she chided as he ushered her inside. "Well, you look like a mad woman," he observed, a hint of worry in his voice, like he was considering that she might in fact have gone mad at last. "It's the middle of the night." "I'm aware of what time it is, Bran." Charlotte cleaned her glasses on his nightshirt and lifted them to her face. Bran's red hair was sticking straight out to one side, and there was a pillow crease in his cheek. His eyes were only half open. His own glasses were terribly smudged, so she grabbed them and cleaned them too. Then she went to his room, pulled his battered old suitcase from under his bed, and started packing his things for a journey. "Charlie, am I going somewhere?" he asked from the doorway. We are going somewhere." She closed the suitcase and straightened. "You have a horse, right? Father's horse?" Bran was shaking his head. "I have a horse, but I can't leave. I'm the parson now. The townspeople need me."
"I need you," she said. "They'll get by."
"What if someone dies and needs a funeral? Or wants to get married? Or needs me to pray over a sick child? And I have a sermon to give?"
Charlotte gave her brother a look. They both knew nobody was going to miss his sermons.
"Oh, all right," he sighed.
He'd learned over the years not to cross Charlotte when she had her mind set on something.
"Where are we going?"
"Why, to Thornfield Hall, of course," she said, as if it was most obvious.
Bran frowned.
Thornfield Hall. What for?
To learn what happened firsthand, which is why I need you, brother.
Why do you need me? He asked.
To talk to Mr. Blackwood. She couldn't help a hopeful smile. Because you'll be able to see him.
And I won't. Bran gasped. Of course, Alexander could be a ghost. He was finally catching on.
Charlotte nodded. We'll find out what happened with Rochester. I suppose we'll have to be careful since Rochester is probably still there, but we'll locate Mr. Blackwood, and you'll talk to him, and he'll... Her voice wavered with the blasted tears. He'll tell us what to do.
She could see by his expression that Bran didn't think this was the wisest idea, but he didn't argue. Instead, he went to the desk in the corner and wrote a note to post on the parsonage door to the people of the village, explaining that he'd be back shortly.
We will be back shortly, won't we? He asked her.
She had no idea when they'd be back. It all depended on what they discovered when they got to their destination.
Of course, she answered. We'll be back before you know it.
They reached Thornfield Hall a day or so later, only to find the great house in total ruin. There'd obviously been a fire. The stones were black and the smell of smoke was heavy in the air. The front of the house was still standing, but it looked fragile, as if the wind would momentarily blow it in. All the window panes were smashed, and the roof had collapsed. All that remained of the once grand and imposing structure was a wrecked shell.
Bran and Charlotte stood looking at the place, silently horrified. Then Charlotte whispered, "Find him, Bran."
And they picked their way around the edges of the house, Bran calling out,
"Mr. Blackwood! Are you there? We'd like to speak with you, Mr. Blackwood!"
Charlotte's heart beat madly the entire time. On the journey, she'd composed a little speech she'd give to Mr. Blackwood, which went something like this.
"Mr. Blackwood, Alexander, I would like to inform you that you are, you were, I suppose, so sorry, the keenest, most attractive, most intelligent and thoroughly engaging boy that I have ever met, and I am filled with sorrow on account of your untimely demise."
And then she'd ask her numerous questions about his death and Mr. Rochester and what they could do to bring the nefarious villain to justice. But Mr. Blackwood never appeared. Bran called and called for more than an hour, and Charlotte joined him, but Bran couldn't perceive any ghostly presence at Thornfield Hall. Not a single spirit came out to meet them. It was the greatest disappointment yet.
"I'm sorry, Charlie," Bran said as they trudged back to where the horse was grazing. "He's quite all right."
She didn't cry this time.
"Obviously Mr. Blackwood has moved on. He's in a better place now. I wouldn't wish him to be a ghost just so I could..."
She swallowed.
"I'm glad for him."
"I'm sorry, Charlie," Bran said again, slinging his arm around her.
"Thank you, Bran. Let's go home."
They got a room for the night at the nearest inn. At dinner time, they walked to the local pub, and Charlotte gathered information regarding the ruin of Thornfield Hall. It was hard to get a straight story from anyone. The rumours abounded. After an hour of interviews with the local townspeople, this is what Charlotte had been able to ascertain. Mr. Rochester had his wife locked up in the attic. She knew that, of course. Mr. Rochester had tried to marry his governess, but it had all gone afoul when it was discovered that he had his wife locked up in the attic. She knew that too, first hand. People felt very sorry for Mr. Rochester and held a lot of mixed but largely negative opinions about this Jane Eyre person, who had reached above her station, who had deliberately set to entangle poor Mr. Rochester. A treacherous Eve type she was, a tempting siren, but also small and plain and utterly unremarkable in every way. Charlotte held her tongue, barely. The events that followed were thus. Mr. Rochester had gone a bit mad after his failed attempt at bigamy, and he'd lit his own house on fire, killing everyone inside, Rochester, the wife and the girl, all together. Or Mr. Rochester had burned his house down in order to dispose of his wife, and then he and the girl had gone to live in the south of France. Or the wife had set the place on fire and succeeded in doing away with both herself and Mr. Rochester. No one knew what had become of the girl, but Mr. Rochester was most certainly dead. Or Mr. Rochester was most certainly alive. He'd nobly tried to save his wife from the fire, but she'd leapt to her death from the roof of the house. Mr. Rochester had been trapped in the inferno, and part of the house had collapsed upon him. But he'd been pulled out very much alive.
But he'd lost one eye and the vision in the other, therefore being made totally blind, helpless as a wee lamb, a beggar on the streets of London now, very sad. Or his hand was crushed and had to be amputated. Now he had a hook and had been last seen applying for the job of a pirate. Or all of the above. Somehow. As a storyteller, Charlotte liked the nobly trying to save his wife version of the tale best. It felt like the proper ending to redeem a man, sort of. But none of the townspeople had any knowledge whatsoever of a Mr. Blackwood. It was impossible to tell under these circumstances if Mr. Rochester was alive or dead or possibly a pirate, and she was no closer to finding out what had transpired with Mr. Blackwood. "He's not dead," Bran said suddenly.
"You think so? Is he a pirate, then, or a beggar? A pirate is a bit far-fetched, in my opinion. Just because one loses a hand doesn't make a person qualify for piracy."
"Not Rochester. Mr. Blackwood."
Bran was staring at an empty space just past Charlotte's right shoulder. Her breath left her.
"Mr. Blackwood's not dead."
Bran shushed her.
"I'm trying to listen. To the ghost."
"The ghost?"
"The one standing right behind you. Mr. Rochester."
Charlotte glanced behind her, but of course saw nothing.
"You're talking to Mr. Rochester? So he died in the fire after all?"
Bran shook his head.
"Mr. Rochester, it turns out, was possessed by a ghost. Apparently he's not a bad fellow at all, but was being held a prisoner in his own body."
"By whom?"
"By Mr. Rochester."
Charlotte frowned.
"The ghost of his older brother,"
Bran clarified.
"During his clash with Mr. Rochester, Mr. Blackwood discovered the possession and was able to separate the man from his talisman, thereby releasing Mr. Rochester from his spiritual bondage."
"That sounds just like Mr. Blackwood," Charlotte agreed.
"Afterward, Mr. Blackwood departed for London."
Charlotte was crying again. She pulled out a handkerchief.
"Thank heavens! But how, then, was the house destroyed?"
"Grace Poole, who was also apparently employed by Mr. Rochester, the evil one I mean, burned down the house in an attempt to do away with the Rochesters, but they had already escaped."
"But I thought you said Mr. Rochester was a ghost. The one speaking to you, in fact."
"Oh, no," Bran smiled apologetically. "The ghost who is speaking to me now is also a Mr. Rochester, but not the Mr. Rochester. This is Mr. Rochester the eldest, our Mr. Rochester's father. He's been haunting this pub for years, apparently, ever since Mr. Rochester the brother died and took possession of Mr. Rochester, the one we know."
There were, in Charlotte's opinion, entirely too many Mr. Rochesters, but that was of no matter. Mr. Blackwood was alive, in London. She blew her nose, put her handkerchief away, and stood up.
"Well done, Bran," she said to her brother. "Excellent job ferreting out all of this vital information. Now we should go."
"To London, I suppose," Bran said faintly. "To find Mr. Blackwood."
"To find Mr. Blackwood," Charlotte said, beaming. "And to talk to Jane. The story this ghost has told you does not match up at all with the Duke of Wellington's account. I fear that Jane is being led astray. She could be in danger. We need to get to the bottom of the matter immediately."
"All right," sighed Bran. "I'll get the horse."
Upon arriving in London, they went straight away to Mr. Blackwood's flat, only to find that Mr. Blackwood was no longer residing there. A young lady had moved in, the neighbours reported. A small young woman, they said, plain, utterly unremarkable in every way. They stood idly across the street for several hours, waiting for Jane. Presently she arrived in a carriage that bore the crest of the society on the door. She had a large garment bag draped over her arm and a strained expression, as if she was bravely facing up to an unpleasant chore. She ascended the stairs to the flat and disappeared. Charlotte and Bran crossed the street as if to follow, but at the last moment a cloaked figure darted out from an alleyway and pulled them both into the shadows. Charlotte was about to scream, but the man clapped his hand over her mouth.
"It's me,"
he whispered urgently. He held his other hand out to Bran, who'd just taken a wild swing at him.
"It's me, Branwell! I must speak with you!"
He threw back the hood to reveal his face. It was Mr. Blackwood. Trembling, Charlotte lifted her glasses to her eyes and drank in the sight of him. His appearance was more unkempt than usual, his clothing rumpled, his dark hair tousled, his face unshaven. He even smelled a bit like the docks. But Charlotte threw her arms around him.
"Oh, Mr. Blackwood," she cried. "I'm so pleased to see you again. We were told you were dead."
"Wellington tried to kill me," he affirmed.
All at once, they both became aware that they were holding each other. Mr. Blackwood gazed down into Charlotte's face, the corner of his mouth tucking up into a smile. He failed, obviously. "I am pleased to see you as well, Miss Bronte." Charlotte nodded mutely. For a moment, neither of them spoke.
"I saw the ghost of Mr. Rochester," Bran announced proudly. "He told me you'd be in London, and here you are."
Charlotte and Mr. Blackwood stepped away from each other. Mr. Blackwood frowned.
"The ghost of Mr. Rochester? How's that? I saw Mr. Rochester alive and well but an hour ago. He and Mrs. Rochester saved my life."
"He means the ghost of the senior Mr. Rochester," Charlotte explained. "Mr. Rochester's father. I know, it's confusing."
"Oh, well, yes, here I am, in London," Mr. Blackwood said, although he didn't seem entirely pleased about it. "Unfortunately, I cannot say I've made much progress in my new mission to foil the Duke's plans and avenge my father's death, and it seems that Wellington has replaced me with Miss Eyre in order to accomplish his schemes."
"So Wellington is the true villain?"
Charlotte thought this was a marvellous twist in her story, and also, of course, terrible news.
"The most nefarious," Mr. Blackwood muttered. "We believe he means to possess the king. I've been trying to get to Miss Eyre to warn her, but she's always shadowed by the society."
He jerked his head to one side to indicate a pair of large, surly-looking fellows lurking on the corner, just outside of Mr. Blackwood's former flat.
"I could warn her," Charlotte volunteered. "Wellington doesn't know that I know of his treachery. I could simply pay a visit to Jane, a social visit. She is my dear friend, after all. What do friends do if not visit each other from time to time?"
"That would be most helpful," Mr. Blackwood said.
Charlotte blushed. "I'll go right away."
Before she could take a step, however, the door to Mr. Blackwood's former flat opened, and Jane popped out in what was possibly the most extravagant gown that Charlotte had ever beheld. The entire dress was simply huge. Jane teetered dangerously several times as she made her way down the stairs, but always managed to catch herself. At the bottom, she straightened her hat. The same rose hue as the dress with several bows and a large white feather sticking out the front. Then she pulled up the edge of one elbow-length white glove and squeezed herself through the door into the waiting society carriage. The two surly-looking fellows stepped up onto the back of the carriage.
"To St. James's Palace?"
the driver asked, and one of the surly men confirmed the address.
"This is it," Mr. Blackwood whispered urgently. "She's going to the king. We have to stop her."
The driver cracked his whip and the carriage pulled away. They watched it helplessly as it swiftly disappeared around a corner.
"Well then, it's a fine night to pay a visit to the palace, wouldn't you say?"
Charlotte suggested. A muscle ticked in Mr. Blackwood's jaw.
"Yes," he said. "A very fine night indeed."
32. Jane. According to Wellington, the entire future of the society came down to the success, or failure, of Jane's mission tonight. Of course, the pressure might have been exacerbated by the dress.
Can we talk about the dress? First off, the sheer weight of the thing. Jane was a slight person, yes, but surely even the tallest and stoutest of women would be bothered by the heaviness of the gown. Second, the corset. Jane had found a book on the proper way to string a corset, and the gist of it was this. Tighten it until you could barely breathe. Then you were halfway there. Since she was dressing herself, she tied two ends to a bedpost and walked forward to tighten it. But then the bedpost broke, and when the neighbour came over to see what the ruckus was, Jane implored her to tighten the corset for her. Her neighbour acquiesced and then left her with this piece of advice.
Friends don't let friends corset alone.
Next, there were the sleeves. They extended at least 4 inches out on either side of Jane's small shoulders, making it impossible for one to walk through a doorway without turning sideways. And then there were the shoulders, which were bare, as in showing. Jane fought the urge to cover them with something else, something inconspicuous, something like shrubbery. Then there was the crinoline, which was a steel-constructed, dome-shaped attachment that replaced layers and layers of skirts. It was supposed to make using a chamber pot easier, but Jane wondered what good that would do when the entire dress would prevent her from being able to enter the room with the chamber pot, let alone use it. At her wrist hung a drawstring handbag, inside of which was a mysterious book Wellesley called the Book of the Debt. It was supposed to help her in her mission tonight. It hung awkwardly, but expecting some sort of contraption that would hold it under the crinoline, her wrist really was the best option. There was only one conclusion Jane could draw from the style and design of the dress, and it was this. It had to be thought up by men. Then women could in no way outrun them, and with the lack of oxygen to the brain due to a ribcage the size of a fist, they could not outthink them. And with the bright colours, they couldn't hide. No running, no thinking, no hiding. But she had given her word to Wellington and her silent word to Charlotte that she would do this work. And Wellington insisted that this outfit was an appropriate one for visiting a palace, which she was about to do for the first time in her very plain and simple life. The carriage was bound for St. James's Palace, where, apparently, the king required a bit of help with a wayward ghost, and where Jane was also tasked with returning a signet ring. The king was reluctant to call for the society, but it was a particularly obnoxious ghost who had been rattling the royal shrubbery and knocking over the royal vases. Fun fact, it was the same ghost that was responsible for the madness of King George. Asking for help was the first step. The second step was to squeeze oneself into a ridiculous dress, Jane thought. The third step was to save the society. Jane felt uncomfortable carrying the weight of the society's future on her very small shoulders, especially since she had no experience and no training. But the Duke was convinced that the fact that she was a beacon would make up for everything else, and the financial situation of the society was of the utmost urgency. She didn't want to be here. She didn't want to be here. But she was here, and it was all for Charlotte, she reminded herself. The carriage bumped and jostled along the road, and Jane wished she actually were wearing lots of skirts instead of a steel crinoline. At least there would have been some cushioning. One of her guards from the society sat across from her, his back to the horse side, as was the protocol. He did not look to be in the mood to talk, which was just fine with Jane. Helen sat next to him, staring at Jane and the dress and the bows.
"You look like a court jester," she said.
"Thank you," Jane said.
"You're welcome,"
Helen responded. Helen was still grappling with the fact of Jane's being a beacon. She routinely questioned every single one of her actions.
"Am I walking across the room because you want me to?"
she would say. "Don't be silly, dear," Jane would say.
"All right. Am I not being silly because you don't want me to be silly?"
It was rather exhausting. The carriage descended upon the palace, and Jane got out and walked slowly up the stairs, because walking slowly was all she could do in the dress. The king was having a ball tonight, and only the elite could gain entrance. This was the most distressing part of all, for Jane was not educated in the ways of high society. She wished she were wearing a society mask right now, but the king had asked with the utmost discretion. He did not want to scare his dinner guests.
"Miss Jane Eyre," she said to the guard at the entrance.
"Au revoir," the guard replied.
"Lowood Estate."
"Miss Jane Eyre of the Lowood Estate."
Upon entering the palace, Jane curtsied to the king just as she'd practiced. The king noted her dress, counting the bows, Jane guessed. The Duke had sent word to the king that he would recognize Jane by the number of bows on her dress. The king nodded at her, held her gaze for a split second, and then dismissed her with a wave of his hand. Jane assumed he would send for her at his convenience. She hoped it would be sooner rather than later. The evening was horribly long. Not being properly acquainted with anyone, and therefore not being able to make conversation with anyone, Jane went around the room pretending she had seen someone she had recognized and was on her way to meet up with them. But the result was that she just wandered back and forth with an expectant smile on her face that never actually landed on anyone. And do you realize, reader, how hard it is to not smile at anyone in particular when you are in a room crowded with faces? At least Helen was there, but it wasn't really the same as having company since Jane couldn't talk to Helen in public. Exhausted, Jane sidled out of the great room and found a small dark alcove in which she decided to catch her breath and totally not hide, because she was an agent and hiding would be cowardly.
"Miss Eyre," a king's guard said.
Helen made a move to elbow Jane in the ribs.
"Oh, yes, I was just admiring the darkness."
The guard said nothing.
"It's lovely in a palace, the darkness. So much more elegant than regular darkness."
"Good recovery," Helen said.
"Follow me,"
the guard turned abruptly, and Jane scurried as much as one could scurry in that dress to keep up. She followed the guard down a series of corridors and ended up in a room that was comparatively smaller than the others she'd seen so far, but still big. Behind an ornate desk stood a wall of ornate robes, and on top of those robes rested long, curly brown locks of hair. And behind all that, Jane assumed, was the king. He started to turn around, and quickly Jane darted forward and placed the signet ring on the desk. She was back in position a moment before he saw her. She immediately curtsied and didn't speak.
"You are from the society," the king said.
"Yes, your majesty." Jane raised her gaze to meet the king's. That was when she saw him. The ghost, standing next to the king, one hand on his hip, just like the king.
"I am not fond of the society," the king said. "And I am the king of Prussia," the ghost said.
Jane tried not to smile.
"I do not believe in this ghost nonsense," the king said, waving his hand as if brushing a fly away. "Nor do I," the ghost said, waving his hand as well.
Helen snorted.
"He's funny."
The ghost then seemed to notice Jane for the first time, and a wide smile broke out on his face.
"My, aren't you a stunning creature? Tell me, have you ever been with a king?"
Jane's cheeks went red.
"Oh, my,"
Helen said. "Sire," Jane started.
"Yes,"
the king and the ghost said simultaneously.
"I can help you." She pulled a talisman out of her satchel. It was a brooch that Wellington said most likely belonged to the tree ghost's beloved grandmother. "But before I do, I need you to do something for me."
The attendants in the room looked to one another uncomfortably.
"Anything," the ghost said.
Jane ignored him.
"You must know what a help and comfort the society can be, especially given your current predicament."
"You're quite overbearing for someone so poor and plain," the king said.
"Who are you calling poor?"
Helen said, gesturing to the myriad bows adorning Jane's ridiculous dress.
"She makes £5,000 a year."
"I can be," Jane admitted. "Please, permit me to help you see the existence of ghosts."
The king narrowed his eyes.
"You mean you wish me to believe?" "It's not that I don't believe in ghosts. I just didn't understand how bothersome they could be until this one came along."
The tree ghost bowed.
"Would it help to talk to him yourself? I can show him to you." She took the Book of the Dead out of her satchel and set it on the desk. She opened it to a page she'd had tagged and read the words as Helen ducked behind her. When she had finished, the king glanced around the room, noticing nothing out of the ordinary, until he looked behind him. There was the tree ghost glancing around the room as well.
"I see no one," the tree ghost said.
The king startled at hearing the ghost and stepped backward.
"This is madness," said the ghost.
He glided over to Jane.
"I would have you detained were it not for your extraordinary beauty."
The king went from looking surprised to looking rather puzzled. He shook his head and approached the tree ghost.
"You, sir, must leave the palace at once." "Why would I leave my home?" the ghost said.
The king closed his eyes and took a deep breath. When he opened them, he seemed much more calm.
"There is a better place for you,"
the ghost scoffed.
"Better than a palace?"
The king nodded.
"Better than a palace. I don't believe you. Off with his head."
The ghost flicked his hand toward the king. The king took a step closer.
"I understand you feel an attachment to this place, but you are not meant to be here, walking the grounds as a spirit."
Suddenly Helen stepped forward, and the king noticed her for the first time.
"Forgive me, sire," Jane said. "This is my companion. She is also a ghost."
Helen stared at the king.
"What do you mean, he is not meant to stay here?"
Helen asked.
"Sire," Jane whispered. "Say, sire."
"Sire,"
Helen said. The king waved his hand as if she shouldn't be concerned about such things. Now that he had seen ghosts for himself, protocol seemed unimportant.
"He is a spirit," the king said. "Spirits are meant to move on to the next life, whatever that may be." "I would not mind staying with her,"
the tree ghost said, raising his eyebrows and looking at Jane. Before anyone could look surprised again, Jane spoke up.
"I am what's known as a beacon," Jane said. "Ghosts are attracted to me."
To give the king credit, he hid his surprise well.
"You can come with me," Jane said to the ghost. "I can help you move on."
"Why is moving on so good?" Helen said. "Especially if you don't even know where moving on goes."
"Helen,"
Jane whispered. The king waved his hand again.
Because it's supposed to happen that way. We must believe that the god who put us here, with families and companions and food and beauty, he has a place for us when we are no longer living. We must have this faith, the faith that we will again be with those we've lost. But you won't discover this promise if you linger here among the living.
Jane relaxed. She hadn't had an explanation for what awaited the spirits moving on. She hadn't wanted to dwell on the thought. Then she looked at Helen, who was staring at her, with a pained expression. Perhaps she was looking at the why.
Ghost, the king said, would you like to say farewell now? And follow Miss Eyre. She will take you where you need to go.
The ghost frowned, but then bowed.
I shall follow the instructions of my top adviser. Thank you, good fellow.
He went to pat the king on the back and actually made contact. His emotions were so strong.
Excellent, the king said with a cough. Miss Eyre, you will guide him from here.
Yes, sire. Jane spared one last glance at the ring on the king's desk, and figuring her mission was accomplished, walked out with the tree ghost and Helen in tow. Once in the hallway, Helen stood in front of Jane, and had she been a solid human instead of a ghost, she would have prevented Jane from walking. Still, Jane stopped.
Why am I here?
She set her hand on her hip. Because you wanted to come to the palace with me, Jane said.
That's not what I mean.
Jane had a sinking feeling she knew what Helen meant.
Why are you helping ghosts to move on to the place we are supposed to move on to, and yet I stay with you?
I don't know, dear, Jane said, but maybe it is because I need my closest friend, and she needs me. Are you not happy? Helen frowned, and her lower lip trembled.
I don't know. I don't know if happiness exists for ghosts here.
That can't be, Jane implored. I've seen you happy, Helen sniffed.
But what if that's simply a reflection of you? You're a beacon, I'm a ghost. Is that why I've stayed?
She raised her voice.
Is that why I lingered?
Jane glanced around to see if they had drawn attention, but there were only uninterested guards in this corridor, and also Helen was a ghost. Helen, please, you saved me at Lowood. You are my kindred. I can't imagine life here without you. Helen frowned.
But maybe you were meant to live it without me.
She turned and ran down the corridor, and Jane would have followed, but it was definitely against royal protocol for a woman in a dress and heels to run. And she had the tree ghost now. Follow me, she said. It was a long walk back to the ballroom, and then down the stairs, and then to the entrance of the palace, and during the walk, all Jane could think about was Helen. She would not leave Helen. Helen needed Jane as much as Jane needed Helen. Helen was an anchor, a lighthouse, a compass, showing Jane the better way. Sure, she was still a bit naive, and she hadn't progressed emotionally or intellectually, as Jane had, but she was a ghost, and that was fine. But what if she left? The tree ghost stayed close by Jane's side as they approached the grand doors. Jane held the talisman at the ready if he suddenly decided to bolt, but he didn't.
Where did your friend go? He said.
I don't know, Jane whispered, not moving her mouth because there were people around.
Is she coming back?
Jane didn't answer. She didn't want to think about the possibility that she would never see Helen again. The guards heaved the doors open, and suddenly Helen came rushing in.
Jane!
She said. Helen! Jane replied, causing the guards to look at her with confusion. Jane quickly turned around and motioned Helen to follow her.
I knew you wouldn't leave me. It's not that, Helen said. I saw Mr. Blackwood.
His ghost, Jane said.
No, him. He's alive. He said the Duke is bad. He has a message for you.
She ticked off her pointer finger as if she wanted to get the message perfectly correct.
He said, don't put the ring in the king's study because the Duke wants to possess him. Phew.
She put her hand to her stomach and took several deep breaths in.
That's it.
Wait, Jane said, not even bothering to keep her voice quiet. Wait, Mr. Blackwood is alive. Jane felt a moment of relief that Mr. Rochester hadn't killed him. Helen nodded, wheezing.
And don't forget the other part I told you.
The Duke is bad, and don't put the ring in the study because he wants to possess him, Jane said.
Oh, good. Your memory is so good,
she smiled.
We did it.
But, Helen, I already put the ring in the study, Jane exclaimed.
Oh, right,
Helen said. The door guards started to approach her. Jane, Helen, and the tree ghost started to walk away.
How could the Duke possibly possess the King anyway? Jane said.
The ring is a talisman, Helen said. It's holding a ghost who can control the King.
Jane's heart sank. We have to go back to the study. Just then, trumpets sounded, indicating the King had once again entered the ballroom. The three of them rushed inside, and there was the King sitting on his throne.
Tree Ghost, can you go to him? Distract him?
But the Tree Ghost only backed away.
That is not the King.
What?
Of course he's... Jane caught a glimpse of the King's hand, and on it was the ring.
No, we have to get out of here and find Mr. Blackwood, Jane said. He'll know what to do. Stay with me, Helen.
Always,
Helen said. 33. Alexander. Within the first 10 days of Wellington controlling the King of England, Mr. Mitton, as the King, issued several royal proclamations. The first was that everyone should recognize that his coronation had been the most attended coronation of all time, period. Even though it had been 4 years ago, and really, who even cares? The second decree dismissed Parliament and appointed Wellington as Prime Minister. Meanwhile, Alexander and everyone else who knew the truth about the King's possession were living in a warehouse off the river. It was undignified and unsanitary, and to make matters worse, they were out of tea. But they were together, and that was something. After Miss Eyre had emerged from the palace, she and Miss Bronte had embraced and bounced and embraced some more. Miss Eyre relayed Miss Burns' happiness to see Miss Bronte, and then Alexander and the three young ladies returned to the warehouse, where Miss Eyre saw the Rochesters for the first time since Thornfield. It was super awkward.
Hello.
Mr. Rochester shifted his weight.
I'm Edward Rochester. Pleased to meet you.
Miss Eyre just stared at him. Then Mrs. Rochester swept in and took Miss Eyre's hand. Hello, mon chéri. Wonderful to see you again. Her smile was so warm and radiant that Miss Eyre returned it, obviously surprised. Good evening, she said. I know what you've been through, but we Beacons are strong and resilient. You shall overcome it. What about what you've been through? Miss Eyre asked. As I said, ma chérie, overcome. The joyful reunion was cut short when news of the royal decrees reached them. To be perfectly honest, Alexander was feeling rather sick about the whole thing. He didn't sleep anymore. Rather, he lay awake going over every conversation he'd ever had with Wellington, searching his memory for some hint that this had been coming. What had he missed? That was probably the most disappointing thing of all, his own failure to stop all of this before it happened. After that, he'd taken to reading Miss Bronte's notebook, which he'd retrieved from its hiding spot the first time the Rochesters allowed him out of the warehouse. He knew he should return it right away, but curiosity made him open it one night. After he came to a charming passage about burnt porridge on page 27, he couldn't stop reading. Some pages were the budding story of fictional Miss Eyre and fictional Mr. Rochester, while others were beautiful descriptions of people and places. Alexander was certainly no literary expert, but he knew at once that Miss Bronte possessed some faculty of verse. The final entry read, "Do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. I have as much soul as you and full as much heart, and if God had gifted me with some beauty and much wealth, I should have made it as hard for you to leave me as it is now for me to leave you. I am not talking to you now through the medium of custom, conventionalities, nor even of mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, just as if both had passed through the grave, and we stood at God's feet, equal, as we are." Alexander paused at that paragraph, dated the day of the doomed wedding, and turned every phrase over in his mind. He could hear Charlotte in those words, feel the passion and conviction of the author's feelings, not just the characters she was writing about, but hers. He'd read some secret part of her heart. He really should give the notebook back. He read the passage again and again, until he fell asleep. The next morning, the group was collected on a circle of crates piled into uncomfortable imitations of sofas and chairs. Someone had managed to procure bundles of blankets and pillows, so they'd been able to put together a semblance of living quarters, one for the ladies, one for the men, and one for Mr. and Mrs. Rochester, who refused to be separated for any length of time now, even though the couple sharing a space was something of a scandal.
Remember, these were different times. Married couples of high rank didn't always share a room. Speaking of scandals, Miss Eyre spent a lot of time watching the Rochesters from the corner of her eye, unconscious of the frown she wore and Miss Burns's occasional jabs. Like right now.
They make such a handsome couple.
Miss Burns mused. She was sitting on a crate next to Miss Eyre, tapping her forefinger on her chin.
Look how age-appropriate they are. I just love it.
Miss Eyre's frown deepened as she elbowed her ghostly friend, but of course she passed right through.
No, just being rude, Miss Burns said. I've told you 1,000 times that it's rude to go inside ghosts.
Sorry, Miss Eyre said. Across the crate parlour, Miss Bronte watched what to her must have looked like Miss Eyre antagonising and apologising to empty air.
We're just sitting around, Alexander groused. We should be doing something.
Like what? Bramwell paced the length of the room, his arms crossed and his brow furrowed in thought. He'd become the parson of Haworth, if Alexander recalled, and already the position had matured the boy far more than his time at the society. Good for him.
"We need to get the ring off the king's finger," Miss Bronte said. "Or rather, Mr. Mitten's finger. Technically the king's, but I suppose it's under Mr. Mitten's control."
"Doesn't that make it Mr. Mitten's finger?" Bramwell turned to Miss Eyre. "You were possessed. What do you think? Is it Mr. Mitten's finger? Or the king's finger?"
But before Miss Eyre could open her mouth, Miss Burns leaned forward.
"Maybe we should ask Mr. Rochester. Since he was possessed the longest and made to do all sorts of things he wouldn't normally."
Miss Eyre, who'd been translating for the two in the room who couldn't see ghosts, abruptly stopped. Unfortunately for her, Bramwell picked up where she left off because Miss Burns wasn't done.
"Remember when Roland possessed him and tried to make him marry Jane, even after being mean and manipulative?"
Miss Burns shot a dark look at Rochester. The real Rochester, who'd done none of those things except as an unwitting vehicle for his dead brother's actions. As Bramwell finished echoing Miss Burns's words, he clamped his mouth shut and blushed furiously.
"Sorry."
Meanwhile, Miss Burns smiled, triumphant. Mrs. Rochester was also blushing, her gaze aimed straight at the floor, as though she could will away all the terrible things that had happened, including her husband's possession.
"Can we just get back to the problem?" Miss Bronte said. "Saving England?"
"Right."
Alexander fidgeted with his gloves, because talk of talismans always made him check to ensure those gloves were firmly in place.
"The king is constantly surrounded by guards, and he's not going to let us waltz right up and take the ring off his finger."
"Of course not,"
Miss Bronte said over a cup of hot water. Everyone had a cup, actually, though no one was drinking. The news about the tea had truly been a blow to the group.
"Which means we need a plan. Fortunately, I have one in mind."
Alexander was not surprised. Miss Bronte leaned forward. "I've always thought that good plans need to have firm goals, so we start with the ring."
"Everything should fall into place once the king is himself again," Alexander agreed. "It's just returning the king to himself that's the problem."
"Exactly," Miss Bronte jumped to her feet. "So, here's my idea."
Everyone waited. Even the Rochesters leaned forward in anticipation.
"We storm St. James's Palace," Miss Bronte announced, "and Jane and Mrs. Rochester use their beacon powers on Mr. Mitten the ghost and ask him nicely to take off the ring."
"That's a fine plan," said Mrs. Rochester, "but our beacon powers of compulsion do not work on ghosts currently possessing someone."
"Otherwise I could have prevented Roland from taking over Edward for so long, and Miss Eyre would have saved herself an incredible amount of trouble."
Miss Bronte frowned.
"But ghosts still find beacons irresistible when they're possessing people, right?"
"Yes," said Rochester. "That seems to be the reason Roland was attracted." He coughed. "But there seems to be something about the living body getting in the way of the compulsion."
"All right," Miss Eyre said. "So we can't compel Mr. Mitten to leave the king. What's your next plan, Charlotte?"
Miss Bronte sat down.
"Maybe we can figure out the ring bit when we get there," Miss Eyre said. "The answer will just come to us, like magic."
"There's no such thing as magic," Miss Burns muttered.
Everyone, except Miss Bronte and Rochester, looked at the ghost.
"I mean, that kind of magic,"
she rolled her eyes.
"Anyway," Miss Eyre said, "we'll figure it out when we get there. I think we need to discuss how to storm the castle."
"Technically, it's a palace."
That was Miss Bronte, of course.
"It looks like a castle."
Miss Eyre crossed her arms.
It's a palace that looks like a castle, but really, it's a palace. Miss Bronte looked to Alexander as though asking for help.
Let's get back on track, he suggested. I'd also like to propose that we don't need to storm the, palace or castle, whatever you want to call it. After all, Miss Eyre, doesn't everyone believe you're still part of the society? You can request an audience with the king.
Oh, Miss Eyre frowned. I suppose that's true. Mr. Blackwood, I believe I was the one announcing the plan.
Miss Bronte stuck her hand on her hip. Go home, Miss Bronte. She rolled her eyes.
As I was saying, we're definitely not storming the palace, since Jane can get us in the front door with a lot less mess. But we're going to call it Storming the Palace, because that sounds far more exciting. And once we've stormed the palace, we get the ring off Mr. Mitten's finger. Somehow. Possibly by magic.
And that's it. Watcher looked dubious. We just walk in and take the ring from him, in front of his guards and all the court. I don't see how this will work.
Mrs. Rochester sat up straight. Magic! Le livre de l'esprit errance. We distract everyone with ghosts. Miss Eyre frowned.
They'd have to be able to see ghosts first, Bramwell said, and we can't do that without briefly killing them. And what if we mess up? I don't want to permanently kill someone.
We can make them see ghosts, though. Mrs. Rochester clasped her hands together. Miss Eyre and I can ask the ghosts of London to join us in the palace. And when the time is right, we make everyone see the dead. That's when we seize the opportunity to remove the ring from the king's finger. Voila! But how?
Miss Bronte glanced around the room, looking vaguely where Miss Burns sat. She knew Miss Burns had been there, at least, because people kept looking there. A longing filled her gaze.
How can non-seers see ghosts? Le livre de l'esprit errance, said Mrs. Rochester. With this we could make everyone see ghosts. But it can be dangerous. People do not always react well to seeing the dead. There will be chaos.
Miss Eyre lifted a hand. But we want a little chaos, said Bramwell, to distract everyone while we wrest the ring from the king.
He paused a moment.
I'm a poet, Charlie.
Don't call me Charlie.
But I do rather like this plan, said Alexander. Seeing all the ghosts of London, that's certainly not something anyone would expect to see in the royal court.
Unless they're also seers,
Miss Burns beamed. Then they'd be working for the society, Alexander said. Wellington never met a seer he didn't want to control. Except me, Bramwell shrugged. It's all right, though, really. I quite like being a parson. Blessing sermons and writing babies. So, we need the Le Livre de Esprit Errance. Rochester turned to his wife. Do you know where Wellington keeps that, my love?
Miss Eyre opened her mouth, but Mrs. Rochester was faster. I'm afraid the Le Livre de Esprit Errance is quite impossible to obtain, mon chéri.
Mrs. Rochester dropped her eyes.
He keeps it locked in a room guarded by a three-headed dog, which drops into a pit of strangling vines, followed by a life-or-death, life-size game of chess, which opens into a room with a locked door and 100 keys on wings. And then there's a mirror.
Bramwell gasped. That's horrible. That poor three-headed dog. I bet he just keeps it in his desk, Alexander said. Are you sure that obstacle course of death isn't something else?
Mrs. Rochester tilted her head.
Oh, I think you're right.
Miss Eyre stood up. Even if the book is located in his desk, Miss Bronte said, it might as well be behind a hungry lion. How will we get into the society?
Miss Eyre might be able to get it, Alexander said.
That's what I've been trying to tell you. She put her hands on her hips. I have the Book of the Dead with me.
What?
Alexander lurched to his feet.
Why didn't you lead with that? The Book of the Dead is our biggest asset. This changes everything.
Miss Eyre let out a huge sigh, then retreated to her crate room, and when she returned, she carried the Book of the Dead.
I took it to the castle.
Palace, Miss Bronte muttered. With me, to make the king able to see the tree ghost, and I didn't have time to give it back before Helen told me you were all outside, and that Wellington was evil.
Miss Eyre smiled and opened the book.
Here, we can practice. I'll read this, and Charlotte, if you can see Helen, then it works.
All right,
Miss Bronte stood and straightened her dress. I'm ready.
Miss Burns stood, too, right in front of Miss Bronte.
Miss Eyre read the incantation aloud.
Ostende nobis quod est post mortem, nos videre prestigiae.
Miss Bronte jumped, of course, because Miss Burns was standing right in front of her, grinning widely.
Helen?
Miss Bronte's soft voice was filled with excitement as she looked right at the resident ghost.
He looked just like Jane's paintings.
Miss Burns squealed and clapped her hands.
Finally!
Miss Bronte smiled. She had a nice smile, Alexander thought, slightly crooked, very charming, and wholly genuine in the way her face lit with joy. Now, she said, we storm the castle.
I thought it was a palace,
Miss Burns grinned. Whatever, Miss Bronte lifted her spectacles. Let's storm it. 34. Charlotte. Are you ready? Came Mr. Blackwood's voice. It's nearly time. Charlotte shook her head.
Mr. Blackwood, I must protest. This isn't remotely proper.
Let's see.
I feel more comfortable in my normal attire.
Let's see, he insisted. She moved out from behind the wall of crates they'd piled up to serve as an impromptu dressing room. Her face burned. She was wearing trousers, something she'd never imagined herself doing in her life, plus a fine button-up shirt that used to belong to Mr. Rochester, and knee-high leather boots with tissue stuffed into the shoes. She stared down at the boots, pulling her ponytail over her shoulder. She didn't have her spectacles in place, but she could still feel Mr. Blackwood staring at her. She wondered if he would laugh. "We discussed this quite thoroughly this morning," he said at last. "The society doesn't often employ women."
"Which makes no sense."
"Which makes no sense," he said gently. "But it's the reality we're faced with. As far as Wellington knows, Miss Eyre is still a faithful agent of the society, so the rest of us will have to go in disguise. You're a footman."
"Very well," she grumbled. "But I don't like playing a boy. I'm perfectly at ease as a woman."
"So you are," he agreed. "But the clothing suits you, in my opinion."
"Oh."
She didn't know whether to be flattered or offended. "I mean, I would never mistake you for a man, but you must admit it's far more practical than that birdcage you're always wearing."
It feels strange.
Strange didn't begin to describe how she felt, but at least she could breathe without impediment. She felt unbound, unmoored from the stifling constraints of her gender. She felt like she could be quite capable of anything. She smiled in spite of her mortification. Mr. Blackwood reached for her hand, which was clutching her glasses, and held them up for her. He was smiling too. He'd been in a good mood all day, dashing about, preparing. Like this business of confronting the king was not terrifying, as Charlotte found it, but merely putting him a step closer to the revenge he'd been seeking half his life. His dream within his reach once again.
"I know there's not time now," he said, "but we should get you some proper spectacles. The sort that you wear on your face."
She shook her head. "I had those type once. They hurt my nose, and I looked..." Dreadful, she wanted to tell him, but she didn't wish him to picture it.
"What matters is for you to be able to see."
He let go of her hand and held out a plain black jacket. Charlotte slipped her arms into the sleeves. The coat, like the boots, was much too large, but there was nothing to be done about it. Just then, Jane came into the room, wearing the same enormous dress that she'd worn to see the king the previous time. She looked at Charlotte and heaved a great sigh.
"How is it?" Jane asked. Charlotte shrugged. "Comfortable. I could go directly to sleep. However do men get anything done?"
"You look just like a fledgling agent." Mr. Blackwood reached into his pocket and withdrew a black society mask. For a moment he seemed about to tie it on, but then he remembered that he was not playing the part of an agent tonight.
He sighed and put it back into his pocket. Jane blushed and donned her own mask.
"Let's go now. I don't believe I can stand any more waiting."
"Do you have the book?"
Jane pulled the Book of the Dead out of her handbag.
"And I've read it cover to cover. I know the words."
"Excellent," he said. "Bramwell!"
The Rochesters appeared in the warehouse doorway, also dressed as men, although that was only strange on Mrs. Rochester, who still seemed to gleam like a star in whatever she was wearing. Bran popped up behind them. His hair was messy, his glasses inexplicably smudged again, and half of his shirt tail was hanging out. But his eyes were bright with excitement.
"Are we going yet? It's nearly sunset."
"We're going." Alexander swung his own coat onto his body in one fluid motion. Charlotte lifted her glasses to her face to admire the view as he strode toward the door, his coat billowing behind him, his steps purposeful. She gave a faint sigh.
"Mr. Blackwood, As they went headlong into this danger, she was flooded with the urge to tell him all the things that had come to her when she'd thought he was dead, to say the words out loud. He stopped, turned.
Yes?
But now was not the proper time.
Oh!